Studios at Universal Orlando Resort.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Smart Clock Podcast is back once again.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special report.
Finally, The Rock has come back to Washington, D.C.
Welcome to WCW Monday Nitro. We're on the air for three.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to a nostalgic look at wrestling's yesteryear. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is your Manic Mondays podcast presented by the Smart Plug Galaxy. I am your host, Amir Arzanani, and joining me as ever is the creator of the concept, the Bubba Ray to my Devon, Steve Neal.
Why do I have to be the white guy?
God damn it, you're always the black man.
It's down to my supremely thick piece. It's not at all. Yes. It's very wispy.
It's quite meaty in my opinion.
Anywho, on this week's Manic Mondays podcast, we are going to be having a little bit of an Austin fest. Yes, 316 Mania has finally hit Manic Mondays and the Smart Plug universe. We've avoided talking about it for, what, 8 episodes now? But we have no choice. No choice but to really put to the forefront the hottest burning talent in the history of the WWE. No one has ever got so hot, so fast, so on top than Stone Cold Steve Austin. And we're going to be talking about his incredible and definitive rivalry with Mr. McMahon that was so instrumental in the outcome of the Monday Night Wars in the favor of the WWF. And we're also going to be talking about his turn and his character as part of the Alliance angle post WCW and ECW's demise. We'll also obviously have our mid-carders of the week and matches of the week to round out the show. So, Beast, should we get into a little bit of, should we do it in chronological order and start with a little bit of 316 whooping the boss's ass?
Yes, let's get into the ultimate fucking counterculture that was Austin versus McMahon. Would you like to start, sir?
There are so many places to start in terms of the birth of the Austin character. There are so many memorable moments, whether it was King of the Ring, Jake the Snake Roberts, and 316 says I just whooped your ass, whether it's going through to the WrestleMania match with Bret Hart, where he refuses to tap out and is that iconic image of him bleeding from the face in the sharpshooter and passing out because he refused to submit to that dastardly face, Bret Hart. But there is nothing that can put someone over like saying, I'm going to boot my boss in the balls every single week. And the moments that were created, the spectacles, whether it was the beer truck, whether it was kidnapping Mr. McMahon at fake gunpoint, which was a pretty contentious and controversial thing to do on any platform, making Mr. McMahon piss himself in the middle of his ring, damn it. Whether it was the cage match at, was it Valentine's Day Massacre, when the giant Big Show, Paul White, made his debut in the WWF and threw Austin through the cage, handing Stone Cold victory, and Mr. McMahon's master plan was undone. Whether it was ladder matches for the ownership of the WWF, whether it was Austin being the chairman for a while of the WWF, which that might be my favorite Austin segment maybe ever. Does it beat the beer truck? Does it beat cementing cars?
What, the one where he's standing on the mount of shit and he's going around the headquarters like having beer drinking contests and shit?
Yeah. It's amazing where he just fills the he fills Vince's office with actual bullshit. Since you love bullshit so much, Vince, I'm going to fill your office with bullshit. It's just amazing. Just sitting there at that board meeting, it just opens up with him at a board meeting, just firing people every time they open their mouth. You shut your mouth, make me a beer. Just sitting there cracking out beers and making them have drinking competitions. If I look up and you're not drinking, I'm going to whoop your ass. It's just brilliant. Carny Stone Cold shit. And they just keep cutting to these vignettes through the course of Raw of just him rambling all over WWF towers, just fucking destroying everything, firing people, promoting randoms and making them his assistant. It's just brilliant. Whether it was him coming to the aid of his mortal enemy, Vince McMahon, to save Stephanie from the clutches of the evil Undertaker in the Black Wedding of the Ministry, and still whipping Vince's ass. It's the thing with Austin was, of course, he was counterculture. So he is standing there on prime time cable TV. And he is flipping the bird. He is swearing, not just saying ass, but he's, you know, shit, bitch, crap, constantly. Obviously giving no shit. And he was the epitome of what it was to be that redneck in the best possible way. It's kind of the only period in history where everyone wanted to be a redneck. It made rednecks cool for the only time ever for the rest of the world outside of the American South. It was like, yeah, actually, you know what? I want to walk around all day drinking beer, not giving a shit, kicking the shit out of people and feeling cool. Everyone wanted to take on their boss. They wanted to take on that figure of authority. So for me, growing up at that time, you know, I was at school and I wanted to beat the shit out of every single one of my teachers. And it was that thing where Stone Cold made you think, maybe I can. Maybe I can. Maybe at the end of the day, Austin, well, he got fired on a number of occasions, but he didn't give a shit and go anywhere. He was just like, ha, shut your mouth. And it just made you kind of think, well, I won't get expelled if I stunner my teacher, throw him through a table and smash him in the face with a steel chair. He was just that figure. He was that guy. We'd never really seen it happen to this extent on TV. He was getting shat on by Vince and then shat on by Vince and the corporation and then shat on by the corporate ministry. And, you know, the whole time he had to contend with other threats as well, whether that was kind of coming from Mankind and the Union, of which he was never a part because he was the lone wolf. You know, everyone else kind of had factions, whether it was kind of the Heart Foundation or whether it was the Nation of Domination, DX, the Union, the Ministry, the Corporation. There was factions everywhere. Everyone had groups. Everyone had buddies. You know, The Rock even had, you know, The Rock and Sock. You know, there was always... Everyone was teaming up. Everyone had their backup. And Austin was the only one who was entirely alone. He had no backup. He had no plan B. He had no kind of defender or protector or partner. It was just him. I know that there was a little period where he teamed up with Dude Love, which was fucking hilarious. But he was basically just his own guy doing his own thing and fuck the consequences. And that's what made him just so amazing. And the whole thing was just... It was emotional. Yes, there were, you know, good matches in there and there were some shit matches in there, obviously, because Vince was involved and he is most certainly not a wrestler. But there were spectacles. And you know what? Even when there were bad wrestling matches, when Stone Cold and Vince were involved, you didn't care about the quality of the wrestling because the story meant so much more. And I know, you know, we kind of joke about being smarks and stuff like that, but particularly when you're at that age, you're obviously not a smark. But even now, if I go back and watch that kind of stuff, I'm not a smark. I am a mark. I'm not sitting there doing a Dave Meltzer going, well, this is a 0.75 star match. Shut your mouth. This means 5 star to me because of what it emotionally that impact is. You know, it was just, it's so exciting talking about it. I got goosebumps thinking about the moment that glass broke in that period, especially if it broke when the McMahons are standing in the ring. No matter how many of them there were, he was going to come down and shit was going to kick off. Hell was going to break loose. And that's what the glass was holding back. It was holding back holy hell. And it's just shattered and it is coming for you. And he was just, there was no fear. The fuck fear shirts came later, but there was no fear. he would just pile into that ring when he was outnumbered 6 or 7 to 1 and just start nailing people. Even if he ended up being overwhelmed by the numbers game, he just didn't care. He never once broke in that period. He never once wavered in that belief of, fuck you, I hate you, I love me, go fuck yourself. He was just the epitome and the embodiment of hero, because he was doing what every single regular, normal person watching the programming, whether they were a man or a woman, old or young, wanted to do. We all wanted to kick someone's ass who's in charge of us and telling us what to do. We all wanted to ultimately rebel. He was the one who was showing us the way in so many ways. He's such a factor, along with guys like The Rock, that made my personality when I was at that formative age, you know, that kid, that teenager. He made me into the little fucking shit that I was. And I don't regret a moment of it. You know, I give him credit for it. I don't blame him for it. It was just incredible. You know, whether it was you wanted to, you know, it was your mom or your dad or your guardian, whether it was a teacher, whether it was your boss at work or whoever, you know, the owner of the business that you worked for, whether it was a police officer who keeps coming down on you, you wanted to go stone cold. And he was kind of, you were living vicariously through Austin. I really cannot recommend for people to go back and watch the period between late 97, early 98, kind of after the Montreal screw job, through to late 99 when he went out with injury. That period of 2 years is the hottest in terms of popularity that wrestling has ever been, both for WWF and WCW. But it was the period that pushed WWF over WCW. And, you know, WCW had so much going for it with all the backing and with all of the NWO, but they didn't have the X Factor. And that X Factor was the Austin-McMahon dynamic. And McMahon deserves credit as well. We don't give him that much credit very often because he's a bit of a douchebag, racist, sexist twat. But in this period, he allowed himself to be mocked, vilified all around the world. He became the biggest and best heel in the business and one of the greatest ever as a personality. He allowed himself to be humiliated and embarrassed regularly in the ring in terms of being soaked with beer and shit thrown on him and whatever else. He would spend money that he barely had in order to be able to do these huge stunts. He invested in the angle because he believed and trusted in the talent on the other side of that ring. In Stone Cold Steve Austin, he was right to place his faith in him. And he also allowed himself to be hit an inordinate amount of times in the skull with a steel chair. He is not a trained wrestler. He did not very often put his hand up, by the way, to block anything. He just took it square in the face. And he was doing all of that while he's just turned 72 this week, Vince. Well, happy birthday. Well, last week, should I say. But, you know, what would he have been then 20 years ago? A man in his 50s, a man in his mid-50s, volunteering to get twatted in the face and basically embarking on a wrestling career. It's, you know, he does deserve a tremendous amount of credit for that. This was magic. The kind of magic they've tried to recreate. They've tried to have CM Punk do it. They've tried to have Daniel Bryan do it. These guys taking on the authority, you know. They've tried to kind of cast Seth Rollins in that role at times, taking on the authority, the Triple H and the Stephanie evil angle, the McMahons still there, still going at it. None of them, as good as they all are or were, none of them come close to Stone Cold. And that's got nothing to do with technical wrestling ability, because they are all vastly superior technicians. None of them tell a story in the ring close to what Stone Cold could do. None of them could brawl close to what Stone Cold could do. But none of them made you feel. When Daniel Bryan's entrance hit, you were excited because you were about to see a great wrestling match and get a good yes chant. When CM Punk's music hit, you knew you were going to get a good promo and very good wrestling. When Austin's music hit, you had no fucking idea what you were going to get. The only thing you knew was it was going to be the greatest thing that was going to be on that show that week, without a doubt.
Yeah, I didn't say, I didn't say anything during that because it was so beautifully eloquent. It was like listening to, I don't know. It's like you were giving Austin his Hall of Fame acceptance speech. It's quite incredible to listen to. I loved it. I was just like,
I was
just literally like, you know that fucking gif that I'm always sending on Twitter with Drake standing up at a basketball game,
yeah,
fucking wildly applauding. I just felt like I just could see that over and over. Like every like gif I've ever sent to people with emotional applause, I was like, yes. Like I feel like I should splice in a fucking applause soundtrack after that. It was utterly amazing. Do you know what? I could talk about Austin just as much as you can for hours on end, but for me that was very succinct, so I'm not going to add too much to it. One thing I loved was the counterculture thing. When you're 13 is when Austin really started kicking in the gear. You know, I was 12, 13 years old. And at that point in life, you're just starting to come into the stage. You know, you're heavily into school. You're trying to find yourself as a character. People are bullying you. They're abusing you because you're different, that you look different. Not everybody has obviously the luxury of being a good looking jock. And, you know, I was very short, very fat. As I was starting to create a personality, starting to build and become the person that everybody listens to on this podcast today, I was just compelled to watch Austin. Very much in the vein that you said, he had such a cultural impact on me as a human being, not just in my entertainment. Nowadays, I watch something like A Walking Dead, and I love it, and I find characters like Rick and Negan fascinating, but they don't have a emotional impact on me in the same way. I'm not going to, you know, walk out in the streets and go, right, I'm going to apply what Rick has taught me on The Walking Dead to life, because I'd end up pulling out a Magnum and shooting people that I distrusted. With Austin. It's like,
that's a street, ladies and gentlemen.
That is the American way.
You look different.
Just me walking around on the streets of Portsmouth like there are walkers everywhere. Just fucking shooting everything.
Don't further stereotypes.
I will protect my family. Yeah, exactly. Portsmouth's already like that. It doesn't need another Walking Dead fucking extra charging around with a shotgun. It's a case of Austin helped define me as a human being in the same way Brett taught me all these wonderful life goals and life missions about being a good human being and doing the right thing. Austin taught me that doing the right thing isn't always about being the right person. And I loved this lesson that I was taught from him that, you know what, sometimes you do have to just get up and smack somebody in the mouth. I still remember the first time when I finally just snapped and beat the living shit out of someone that was bullying me at school. And I can almost see myself as I'm wailing away on this toss piece, and just I can hear like fucking JR's voice as a soundtrack over my fucking yes, euphoric moment going, Austin Gough McMahon, just screaming, and I'm fucking nailing this cunt on the floor. And I'm thinking, that was what he taught me as a human being, that people have to stand up and fight, and sometimes it's okay to just be a fucking lone wolf, to just go it alone and beat the living bejesus out of people, to stand up to your boss, to say, no, fuck you, I know what I'm doing is right, fuck you, you're wrong. You know, he had, it's funny, Austin's entire persona, which we spoke about ECW and Austin's initial promos in ECW, and how he was given this creative ability to just be an unhinged badass. I feel like what he represented was very much ECW in terms of personality.
Yeah.
And I felt like do you know what? Whenever you listen to his podcast, he always talks, doesn't he, about when he was in ECW and how Paul Heyman is always the guy that gave him his first opportunity, his first true opportunity to be something different. And he always says, to him, that's where he first got the idea of being like a Stone Cold. And I feel like everything he learned from being in ECW and seeing ECW for what it was always translated. I genuinely believe that I must be one of the few people who's ever touched on this point. I feel that his entire run as the counterculture, anti-authority figure, all of that screamed ECW to me, because that's what ECW was. It was gritty, it was uncomfortable, and it was counterculture. It was a big fuck you to people who didn't believe in their way of doing things. And that's basically Austin's entire mantra throughout that run. It's almost like he carried the soul of ECW into to WWF and personified it as he went charging through the roster. And you mentioned so many great moments. For me, one of the greatest is the Zamboni. I love.
Yes.
Not the con. You know, this is a guy. He drives monster trucks because he's American, and you know he's got a rifle when he goes hunting and all this. But Austin was a different level of redneck, a different idea to what we knew. Sure, he could be trailer park trash, as The Rock would so beautifully call him on the bridge from time to time. And you know, there was the thing to, you know, to try and talk about Austin's highlights is like trying to fucking, you know, break
There's
down
time.
And, yeah, there just isn't. We could have a 50-hour podcast and not even touch on the greatness. It's hilarious. But the Zamboni for me sums up Austin. This, it's like, oh, I'm in Detroit. I'm in the Joe Louis Arena, the most iconic arena in the world in terms of ice hockey. It houses the greatest ice hockey franchise, arguably, in the world. So you could just see the wheels turning in Austin's mind. And he probably thought, Zamboni. What is more iconic to ice hockey than the Zamboni? So, you know, there are so many different ways Austin could get down. And, like, he's surrounded. Vince McMahon's surrounded by security. He's got the Stooge. He's got Kane and The Undertaker. This is the night after they had both pinned Austin at a pay-per-view.
Yes.
To dethrone him. And Austin's like, fuck you. I'm going to storm the ring in the world's slowest moving vehicle. Incredible. Takes out light fixtures. People are like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, kiss my fucking ass as he's steamrolling through this curtain at about 2 miles an hour. And it just, and he charges the ring. And the just everything about it, the imagery, is incredible. It will live forever. I will be an 80-year-old man if I'm lucky enough or unlucky enough to live that long. And I will think to myself, I remember the time he launched off the top of a Zamboni and JR screaming, Austin got McMahon. I will remember the inflatable alligator in the ring that somebody lopped into the ring.
Yeah.
And Kane and The Undertaker just kind of standing there going, well, this is quite the colossal fuck up, isn't it? You know, no one's ever going to remember Vince getting his ankle broken later on by Kane and The Undertaker because he got caught flipping him off. Especially as this was the same night that Vince McMahon called Kane mentally retarded on the microphone. Like, what a special time to be a wrestling fan. And for me, that's my favorite Austin moment. Everyone says the beer truck. I think for quality of promo, I agree with you entirely. The office work is so unique because we had never, as a culture and as people, seen an unhinged lunatic get the better of their boss and actually be, and then get put in a position where they are the boss. Normally it's, I'll beat my boss up and then I'll quit. No, this was a case of we went entirely to the absolute maximum with this. We got to the pinnacle of the storyline. Austin is the boss. Like, this guy who's supposed to walk away. No, he didn't walk away. He was actually put in the ultimate position of power. And to see him standing on a mound of shit, pouring beer over it to incite more of a riot, while Vince McMahon is, like, doing his classic, like, fucking mental breakdown on a via satellite. It's just incredible. It's a level of storytelling that WWE will never touch. It just won't.
No.
Because there just isn't the commitment and passion to a character that Austin brought. So I'm not going to go on. I'm going to leave it there. For me, it's all about going and watching it and going and feeling it for yourself. The monster truck, Austin's funeral with The Rock, all of these play into the moment, but you have to watch it to understand it. You owe it to yourself. Go and watch the stuff on the network. There's great DVDs you can get. There's documentaries, which there's even an Austin versus McMahon rivalry documentary on the network that you can watch, which will encapsulate everything for you. And then from there, you've got the knowledge to go and find the little bits and pieces and see them out in their entirety. Do it and thank yourself later. It is the masterpiece of storytelling. And this is why people scream about the Attitude Era and the good old days of wrestling. This is the pinnacle of it. This is why people still believe, because that level of storytelling, WWE right now doesn't even get to 5% of that creative quality that they had back then. So give it a watch. Do you know what? The good times don't stop, because Austin has had many layers to his incredible character. The final real layer of his character before he really sort of wound down to the end of his wrestling career, so to speak, was his stint in the Alliance. Would you like me to take the lead on this one? As I am,
yeah, go for it, man.
I am unquestionably a huge mark for the Alliance era. I'm one of the only people who really loved it. Austin in the Alliance. When Vince McMahon bought out WCW and ECW in late March and essentially early 2001, leading into WrestleMania 17, they had already thought up the concept of merging WCW and ECW into the product. So they would actually look like they were their own entities, but of course they would fall under the blanket of WWE. And this manifested itself with the invasion angle. A Shane McMahon-led WCW and a Stephanie and Paul Heyman-led ECW would merge as an alliance to try and take down the big corporate monster that was WWF. You know, the evil invaders from the companies that Vince was supposed to buy out, which were taken from under his very nose. And at Invasion 2001, which was actually the name of the first pay-per-view where they had the, you know, the mixed matches, very much in the Survivor Series form where they do SmackDown versus Raw now. They had, obviously, Alliance versus WWF matches across the board. And in the main event, the inaugural brawl, Austin turned on the WWF. He assaulted Kurt Angle. And I believe Booker T got the win in that match. The image of Austin standing there and Vince McMahon being like, what the hell just happened? What's going on? Like, Austin had turned. He'd become this bitter, angry, twisted, maniacal, but yet more calculated, more calm version of himself. And he had aligned himself with Stephanie and Shane. And it gave birth to a lot of different things. People will remember what more than anything else, because this is where it gave birth to it. The infamous promo where he went, your name is Hugh Morris. What? It just, everyone's like, what is he doing? Why is he saying what a lot? And it just stuck. It just stuck and it sticks to this day. But what I loved about Alliance Austin was the unbelievable ruthlessness of how he commanded his leaders. This was the first time you got to see Austin in a truly social environment. We'd had a tease to it in the build up to the Alliance with Austin. Obviously, after WrestleMania 17, he aligned himself with Vince McMahon and he became this kind of weird, uncomfortable, guitar-playing, cookie-hating...
I loved it.
...hugging, man. It was, by far and away, some of the best uncomfortable comedy I've ever seen. Very much akin to, it's like, brilliant. We Love in the Office and Shameless, those kind of things that spaced as well. These British comedies, these TV series, the way they play on people's insecurities and uncomfortable nature. Austin's character did that in the build-up to this, but this was the first time where he was the leader of the Alliance. He was in charge. He was the locker room leader. He was in charge of his troops. And there's so many great vignettes of him backstage. You know, tough love, the way he took his belt off and whipped Taz for being a failure. He hated RVD. I love the fact he hated RVD because RVD was like, okay, man, cool. He's like, what? You don't say cold, Stone Cold. You show me some respect. RVD's like, oh, man, whatever. He's so stony, I don't give a shit. And Austin's just like stir crazy. Like, why don't you talk more? Why are you so stoned? Fuck you. Like, get really angry about the whole concept. And I love the fact that he was constantly testing them. You know, whereas WWF was trying to show unity and they had The Undertaker rallying the troops, Austin is like, get out there, get your ass whipped. Like, fuck you. Like, just this maniacal Napoleonic leader of the Alliance. It was, looking back, people will say, oh, the Alliance ended up being a bit of a joke because it just ended up being full of WWF guys who had just turned. You know, Kurt Angle joined the Alliance on TV, you know, but it doesn't really matter. It's how well do these guys play the storyline? And Austin, for me, like, by the end of it, I remember thinking, God, I just want to see Austin get his ass whipped. And of course, he had the greatest opposite and the greatest foil of his life in The Rock, sitting on the side of WWF. He had come back to save the WWF. Never mind the fact he, you know, there's that great moment where The Rock comes back and he rock bombs everybody. But he says, finally, The Rock has come back to the WWF. And everyone's like, oh, my God. And immediately, the real connoisseurs for Austin Rock. Here we go again.
Yeah.
The highlight for the Alliance period for me, among all else, is the moment leading into Survivor Series. It's on Raw. It's The Rock and Austin, and they're sitting in the ring. They're standing in the ring opposite each other, and it's like, no, you know what? Let's just play it calm. Let's have a moment. And this is a weird, weird, weird moment. But for me, it is the perfect encapsulation of two men who loved being wrestlers and loved entertaining. So Austin and Rock, they start singing country music classics. Anybody knows who Jimmy Buffett is? What? So random. So out there. Like, The Rock's like, yeah, you know, you remember this one. You got to know when to hold him. Yeah. And it's like, what the fuck is going on? We're having sing-along with Austin and The Rock. And Austin's like, oh, excuse me. I just need to clear my singing voice. It's like fucking just this real wacky. Like, I felt I was in the Twilight Zone. But it was the culmination of hilarity. It was
so funny.
Perfect. This summed up the relationship of these two men and their rivalry and the pinnacle of it and how, regardless of what turn they took, they were both incredible. They're icons, and they were so comfortable with each other that they could be the heel and the face, the most beloved face in The Rock and the most disgustingly hated heel in Austin at the time, and yet this crowd were losing their shit and marking out. And these guys had so much faith in their own rivalry and their characters that they spent 20 minutes singing, laughing, joking, smiling. And, you know, I love the image of it with when he goes to shake his hand, they give each other a hug and they're both smiling. You can see it. They're both like, we just did something so cool. And then The Rock stops and he goes, by the way, The Rock will never, ever forget, and hits him with a rock bottom. And it is utterly iconic. So to me, in my opinion, it's the most underrated segment in the history of wrestling. It's not remembered as, you know, with revealment like some of these other great segments, like the beer truck, the Zamboni, but for me, it is the perfect encapsulation of what Austin was in the Alliance and what The Rock meant to him as a four. And of course, it ended at Survivor Series 2001 with the WWF finally overcoming the Alliance. And of course, Austin was right at the centerfold of that. Angle gets in the ring. You're thinking Angle, the piece of shit, he's going to cost The Rock. And Angle swerves at the last minute. Obviously, the little bitch wants to keep his job and he hits Austin with a belt. The Rock hits him with a rock bottom. 1, 2, 3. The Alliance is dead. Paul Heyman is gone. Everybody is gone. And now it is time to merge the product. And of course, the brand will come soon after that. It's actually quite an important time because it basically signaled the end of the Attitude Era and brought in the era that we essentially were leading to all these years. It brought in the era of overall talent and the merging. The things like the draft that we take for granted right now, that was a concept that came from the Alliance because there were simply too many people there. And to see Austin at the centerpiece of that and the forefront of that, and the reality is that he didn't have that many great wrestling matches except for that wonderful rivalry with Kurt Angle right in the middle of it. And eventually Kurt Angle joined. And I think one of my only critiques of it was maybe I didn't want to see Kurt Angle turn to the Alliance so soon after he'd had this ferociously powerful rivalry with Austin. And of course, you know, the tragedy that was 9/11 happened right in the middle of this angle. And that was what pushed them to give the title to Kurt Angle. I mean, who better at that time to create a sense of togetherness than to give it to your Olympic gold medalist, your American hero, Kurt Angle? Some people said that it was obnoxious. I disagree. I think it was the perfect move.
It's perfect.
To make people feel better in a time when everyone was, you know, terrified and very suspicious of the world. And Austin played the perfect foil to that, the perfect heel. And the match at Unforgiven itself is probably the one recommendation I would have, other than the segment with The Rock and Austin. My recommendation would be to go back and watch the match between Austin and Angle from Unforgiven 2001. Not the greatest technical match, because obviously Austin doesn't work on a level like Angle does, but the storytelling and the fact it's in Angle's hometown and the fact that his whole family hoist him up on his shoulders at the end, and Austin plays everything so beautifully, so aggressively. And it was, you know, an absolute pinnacle. It's arguably Austin's most forgotten run as a WWF wrestler, but it's also one of his most important because it fleshed out a character and it gave him depth and it gave him a chance to exercise something that he'd never really had an opportunity to do because he was so busy being the lone warrior and whooping ass. This was a different time for Austin, and even the little things like the music, the sort of slowing down of the glass shattering and that, and everything like that, everything played itself in very nicely. And stuff like that, like his music slowing down, you still see that today with Neville, for instance, when Neville's music changed when he became heel, and so many wrestlers that have come before and after that. there's a lot to be said for what his character helped portray and going forward what it gave to the industry. So go and watch Kurt Angle versus Austin from Unforgiven. Enjoy it for what it is. And remember that time when Austin was a little unhinged and a little different.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. I mean, there's not really anything for me to add. I guess the only thing I'd add is just I love the build-up to his turn on the WWF, because he'd been the hugger. He'd been this kind of very loving guy for a while, hadn't he? Up building it towards
Honey, the old Stone Cold.
And I love that. And he's like literally just like screaming it in his face. And you can see Austin getting furious, like, oh, you want the old Austin? Oh, you're going to get the old Austin. And he does properly swagger down. He's whooping ass. He's making it look like he's the old Austin. Then there comes a screw job. And it's like, well, if you want the old Austin fucking hates Vince. Fuck you. It was everything about it. I love basically everything that Austin did. People didn't like the fact that he turned heel and stuff like that, and I loved it. I loved the heel. Oh, the reason why he did the whole hugger cookie hating kind of angle is because he was injured and he couldn't really wrestle. So they had to come up with something to keep him on TV and keep him relevant. So they just went down comedy entertainment, and with Kurt Angle as his foil, like when they were both competing for Vince's affection, like trying to out hug on Vince. It's just brilliant. Honestly, there's so many
Angle's like, little cowboy hat
back then. Yeah, yeah. It is class. It's absolutely class. You know what that reminds me of? The Kurt Angle cowboy hat kind of segment reminds me of, do you remember there's a Friends episode where Ross has moved in with Joey and Chandler and they've built a fort out of the boxes
yes!
Ross has brought round. Oh, and like they get in and they're in a cowboy hat and an Indian like or Native American kind of headdress, and then comes Chandler and ends up putting like a little squaw hat, and they're like, Joey just goes, stop talking crazy and make me some tea. It's just class. Absolutely brilliant. That's exactly Kurt Angle is Chandler in that situation. It's just absolutely brilliant.
Amazing.
But yes, I suppose we should get on to our mid-carders of the week. That is enough talking about an icon and a legend. Let's talk about some bullshit.
Hit us up on the Twitter if you want to talk more, Austin.
Oh, God, yeah. I'll literally bore you to death with talking about Stone Cold. Okay. My mid-card of the week, I shall go first, as always.
Of course.
And I have gone with a little bit later than normal. It's not an Attitude Era mid-carder for a change. I have gone with the Boogeyman. Oh, yeah.
Right, as an interesting side note, I do a fabulous impression of the Boogeyman.
I will crack it out at some point.
Yeah, I do the walk spectacularly. I must cosplay him just once.
Now, the Boogeyman never won any titles in the WWE. He was never Intercontinental or US Champion or anything like that. He was a worm-eating freak show, basically. And he kind of just popped out of places, particularly at first, before he was really having matches, just kind of popped out and scared people with his crazy demonic look and spitting out the worms and eating the worms. And he started stalking women, basically, that were attached to men. Like he stalked Jillian Hall, which provoked a feud with JBL and stuff like that. He came in October 2005 onto SmackDown. During brand split era, and he spent a couple of years there. His first feud was with JBL, and he actually beat JBL on his pay-per-view debut at the Royal Rumble in 2006 in less than 2 minutes.
Holy shit.
JBL was squashed by the Boogeyman. He then had rivalries with The Miz, had a rivalry with The Miz for a while before a rivalry with Booker T, which actually led to them having a match at WrestleMania 22. Now, that's a shit match, and it is very short. But the reason why it was short was because actually Boogeyman was wrestling injured at the time. But they didn't want to kind of get rid of the match. They just had to change it. And it finishes with him kissing the lovely Charmel with a mouthful of worms and spitting worms into Charmel's mouth. Beautiful stuff. And he actually ended the Miz's undefeated streak as well. The Miz had been undefeated when he first came into the WWE. And the Boogeyman is the man that put an end to that shenanigans. He had some midget-based feuds with Finlay through 2006 and a good old Hornswoggle. And was actually moved to the ECW brand as well, where he spent a couple of years between 2007 and 2009. And he feuded with the likes of the legendary and iconic Big Daddy V,
which really wasn't good.
He also had a brief tag team with Mr. Pipe Bomb CM Punk.
Holy shit.
And actually, yeah, I know, it's amazing, right? Now, his last match as well was against Kane on ECW on March the 3rd, 2009. But the most interesting thing about the Boogeyman, and his real name is Mark Wright, is actually how he got his start in the WWE. Hmm. Now, he was a contestant.
A tough enough story.
Yes. So he's a contestant on season 4 of Tough Enough, which came with a $1 million prize for the first time, as well as a contract to come in and wrestle in the WWE. Now, he got down to, I think, about the last 8 before coming clean about the fact that he was not 30 or under, which was the age limit to be a contestant on Tough Enough. He was, in fact, 40. Now, he'd done well enough at this point that obviously they kicked him off the show, but said, you know what, go down to developmental, OVW, as it was then, and you'll get your chance to learn and improve there. So he went down there. He debuted just as Mark Wright. They tried out a few things. He wasn't down there too long, but he actually debuted his Boogeyman character in OVW before moving up to the main roster. And that's amazing. He cheated on the WWE's premiere reality show, which was going out on cable television and getting quite good ratings. It was a reasonably big deal. It was on MTV, I think. And it was quite a big deal. It was actually won. It's a little side note. It was won, that series of Tough Enough, by a guy called Daniel Puda. And part of the kind of Tough Enough experience in auditions when they got down to the final, I think the final 4, was they all had to, live on SmackDown, go in and have like an amateur takedown wrestling fest with Kurt Angle. One of the guys, I can't remember the name of the guy, but one of the guys was in there with Kurt Angle, and Kurt Angle accidentally broke his ribs because he took him down so hard. To be fair, Kurt Angle was probably drunk at this point. And Daniel Puda gets in there with him, and as Kurt Angle comes towards him to take him down, he's a trained MMA fighter, Daniel Puda. He instinctively locked in a Kimura lock. And Kurt Angle legitimately was like, oh, fuck. He was going to have no choice but to tap. Now, if he was actually in MMA, he would, of course, have tapped pretty much immediately because there's no escape. There's nothing he could do. But he's not in the UFC, and he is the biggest name at that point in the WWE. He's the biggest name in professional wrestling at this point, and he is a gold medal winning wrestler in a wrestling ring. This is not an MMA octagon. So basically, they had to do a screw job with the referee to pretend that Daniel Puda's shoulders were down on the mat with this Chimera lock locked in, which they weren't, just to, so that he would release Kurt Angle and it would make it look as if Kurt Angle had legitimately won and taken this guy down, which was not true. But the Boogeyman, to finish off my little Boogeyman segment, probably the highlight really of his career is the fact that Pro Wrestling Illustrated named him as the Rookie of the Year in 2006. The best newcomer to professional wrestling anywhere in the world was the Boogeyman in 2006. He really didn't live up to his potential, but still, that's quite an amazing feat. And the fact that he was doing that over 40 is quite special as well, really. So my mid-carder of the week is the titleless Boogeyman, the epitome of mid-carder.
Yes, quite the pick, but I have something even more obscure. More obscure than anything. This is an interesting one. A lot of people, I reckon, even when I tell you his name, will go, who? So, as we know, foreigners in WWE, particularly in the early 2000s, didn't exactly have the best run of it. It was either smelly aristocrats or obnoxious, you know, heels with anti-American values. And this guy was no different when he got his start. In 2004, WWE signed a developmental contract to a man by the name of Kenzo Suzuki. I like my obscure. This is the most obscure mid-carder I've gone for by some margin. Definitely. And I think this, for me, is the epitome of what being a mid-carder is, someone that nobody actually remembers. Kenzo Suzuki, of Japanese fame, actually quite the talent for NJPW, including their Rookie of the Year at the very beginning of 2000. A very special talent, by all means. He spent 3 years in New Japan between 2000-2003, debuted literally at the very beginning of 2000 in the Tokyo Dome, which is, you know, the mecca of indie and Japanese wrestling. Anything outside of WWE, that's probably the biggest place you can wrestle if you're not wrestling for WWE. Yeah. So you know that he's got some sort of pedigree. And he went on his excursion, as all people do, which if you're interested in excursions, you're interested in learning about that, check out our Only 50 podcast. Me and Ray are always talking about excursions when we're covering NJPW. It's quite a big thing out there. It's a very cool concept that I think the Western world should adopt more. Essentially, the premise being that once you've had a certain degree of time and training in a company, you are sent abroad to learn other styles and come back as a more well-rounded and more polished athlete. So 2004, he signed with WWE. Obviously, developmental initially, Ohio Valley Wrestling, which is OVW, which is kind of a buzzword, really, when you think about the original development. And interestingly enough, he actually joined with his wife. Her name was Hiroko. So he came in 2004. Didn't really do a fantastic amount. He's one of these weird people that literally never really kicked in. Never did anything of interest. But there are some like little tidbits. He made his debut by defeating Scotty Too High. Which is, you know, very mid-card. How very mid-card of you. He had a very short rivalry with Billy Gunn and beat him at the Great American Bash. The irony of that is not lost on me, I appreciate. And then at the back end of that year, he started tagging with Rene Dupree, who most people remember from La Resistance, who I was very tempted to pick as my mid-carder this week. Rene Dupree, the obnoxious French aristocrat, they actually went to the extent of putting him in one of those obnoxiously glossy blue French robes and having him come out with a poodle and a French flag. They just the ultimate stereotype. And of course, Kenzo Suzuki, as his tag partner would come down, his wife would be in this very traditional Japanese garb, you know, very slowly walking to the ring with her hands clasped. And he had samurai kimono shit on, you know. To some people, it's considered beautiful tradition. To WWE, it's considered carny bollocks. But amazingly, he is a one-time tag team champion with Rene Dupree as they knocked off the infamous team of Billy Kidman and Paul London. How Billy Kidman and Paul London were tag team champions is beyond me. He was another one of these foreigners who was able to take the piss out of himself. Foreigners tend to have a better sense of humor, in my opinion, when it comes to wrestling, particularly in North America. You see it with people like Cesaro and Sheamus, the ability they have to interact with people. You see it with William Regal. He had a very great, dry, witty sense of humor, something that I think Europeans and particularly Brits have more so than Americans really do. They're not really understanding of the concepts of irony and sarcasm as much as we are. That's not to say everybody's like that, but let's face it, we have Monty Python and you don't, so suck it. So they lost their tag team titles to Rob Van Dam and Rey Mysterio. But what I find very interesting is how Suzuki became this pro-American. And what he would do is his gimmick was every week he would tip up on SmackDown and he would attempt to sing a different song, like Born in the USA. Bon Jovi. He'd get his hands on these iconic songs and he would massacre them with his horrifying Japanese accent and his inability to sing. And his wife would just stand there like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like just looking at him like he's some sort of mental patient. And this didn't go on sadly very long. I love the concept of Rene Dupree being this kind of obnoxious poodle-loving Frenchman and just looking at him with such disdain. It was very much a great comedy tag team that never lived up to its potential. It never got a chance to fulfill itself. And I kind of feel sorry for Kenzo Suzuki. This guy came highly regarded from Japan. And nowadays, when someone comes highly regarded from Japan, they're either pushed to the moon or they're shoved into NXT and they're given the opportunity to have five-star matches aplenty. Kenzo Suzuki was chucked out there in a kimono and expected to, you know, just entertain people by singing Bruce Springsteen. It was a weird time for wrestling. And very soon after that, it you know, it fizzled out for him. He had a very small rivalry with John Cena for the United States Championship and actually challenged him to a battle rap, which if you go to SmackDown from January the 6th, 2005, you will see Kenzo Suzuki and John Cena engaging in a battle rap. It is a sight to behold. Unsurprisingly, Suzuki, I know, right? And he wasn't even Doctor of Fugonomics at that point, I don't think. I think he was starting to tune that out and he was becoming, you know, good time, fun time, carny bollocks, John Cena. This kind of signaled the end for Fugonomics for him. Unsurprisingly, he lost to John Cena. And unfortunately for him, he actually had a collapsed lung and was sent back to OVW to recover and obviously train. He was actually traded in the 2005 draft to Raw along with his wife. But he never got a chance to debut. He was actually released right before he was meant to debut, which is a bit of a shame. That's not to say that he hasn't done anything since. He went to Hustle and Consejo Mundial de Lucha Libre, which is, of course, CMLL, as most people will know, one of the most famous brands of Mexican wrestling, and also AAA, where he jumped ship. Both very blood-hot rivalries in Mexico, not very popular with each other. They are essentially, you know, the two warring factions. They are the WWF and WCW of Mexico. And he still, to this day, contributes to wrestling. AAA, as recently as 2015, he was there. He also worked for Dragon Gate. Right now, though, and since 2010 at present, he has been working for All Japan Pro Wrestling. Still, believe it or not, only 43 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you think these guys are sort of, you know, getting on in their years, but he was actually quite young. What's amazing as well is that in getting to All Japan Pro Wrestling, getting back to obviously his roots in his home country, he renewed his tag with Rene Dupree and was working in 2010 with him. My mid-carder of the week, of course, is Kenzo Suzuki, one-time WWE Tag Team Champion with Rene Dupree.
Beautiful. And one of the guys that for the Japanese wrestlers and all their proud traditions, just another one that Vince McMahon has gone, ha! Look at his eyes. They're all stranger shape than mine. Let's put him in weird shit. Ah! That's what makes, in a lot of ways, that's what makes Nakamura so special right now, is the fact that he's like the only Japanese guy ever in the WWE to not be given a ridiculously racist gimmick. Yet.
I'm waiting. I'm still waiting. Oh, man.
Absolutely. So I guess we should close out the show, I guess we should do our matches of the week.
Oh, yes. Hit me up, son.
I did Carny Bullshit last week, so I thought this week I will go straight down the middle and I will pull up a genuinely incredible match. And I've decided to go with a match that I may or may not have referenced before, possibly on a Week in the Universe podcast. And it is, for my money, probably the greatest triple threat in WWE history. It's certainly in that ballpark. And it is from Vengeance 2002.
Main
event.
Here we go.
For the Undisputed Championship. The champion, The Undertaker, in his American badass, big evil kind of gimmick at that point, Biker Taker, versus Kurt Angle, the Olympic gold medalist, and The Rock, the people's champion. This match is truly unforgettable. It is, I think Dave Meltzer gave it 4 3/4 stars, but that's because Dave Meltzer fingers his own asshole. This is a 5-star match. It legitimately is. Throughout the course of this match, we have this finisher fest about halfway through the match. And this match, I think it's about 20 minutes long. It's not so, you know, so they can, everyone gets their shit in. In the most spectacularly brilliant way, without needing to go too long. They don't drag it out. It's not too short, so it cuts it off and feels ridiculous. It's pretty much spot on for timing. Three guys with a great pacing and great chemistry, a lot of experience being together in the ring. They've all got a great history with each other going back a long way, and it tells in this match. But halfway through, we get a finisher fest, but not the finisher fest that you would expect in a traditional match. They all start cracking out each other's finishes. So The Rock suddenly turns around and choke slams The Undertaker. And you're sitting there going, what?
I have never,
I don't think anyone has ever seen The Rock hit a choke slam, a goozle before or since. Then I think The Rock, he locks Kurt Angle in the ankle lock. He reverses the ankle lock that Kurt Angle's trying to lock on him, locks it onto Kurt Angle. The Undertaker interferes. Kurt Angle tries to angle slam The Undertaker, but gets Angle slammed. And then Kurt Angle rock bottoms The Rock. It just all kicks the fuck off. And you're sitting there just creaming everywhere, just marking out, like, oh my God! They're all obviously, you know, there's a lot of near falls, a lot of breakups, a lot of run-ins in it, like from each other, and it's fantastic. No outside interference, no carny bullshit like that. Just three of the greatest superstars in history going hell for leather and just saying, you know what? Let's just go out there and put on a five-star match. And in a lot of ways, it felt like the fact of The Rock was winding down his full-time wrestling career. He goes over, he wins the title, basically setting up so that about a month later at SummerSlam, he drops the title to Brock Lesnar. And we get Brock Lesnar's first title, the youngest ever champion. And the big, you know, it kind of launched him, obviously, into the superstar trajectory off the back of getting the scalp of The Rock. So it's just all set up to tell that story. And it's almost like these three mainstays of the WWE roster, particularly, obviously, The Undertaker and The Rock as well, been there for so long. Slightly less for Kurt Angle. He'd only been there for just over 2 years, around 3 years maybe at this point. We're sort of sitting there going, hang on, are we The Undertaker and The Rock being booked in a match purely so we can tell a story in a month's time to put over Brock fucking Lesnar? Who the fuck is this little shit? No. That's fine. If that's what creative have decided, we're not going to fight against it. We'll do our jobs. We're damn professionals. But by God, we are going to make sure that whatever comes after this, no matter what Brock Lesnar tries to do, he will never have a match this good. He is not going to live up to these standards. It was incredible. I cannot emphasize enough for people to get onto the network or get onto dailymotion.com, get onto YouTube and find this match in full. I think it's about 20 minutes, just under 20 minutes, maybe 19 minutes. And it is balls to the wall, hectic and insane from start to finish. You will not stop loving it from minute one through to the end. Even I love the opening of the match. The Rock and The Undertaker had a main rivalry. The build-up to this, by the way, of all of the run-ins, costing of titles and number one contenderships and people wrestling to draws and run-ins and I'm going to rock bottom both of you because you're arguing with each other, was brilliant. The vignette promo video for this is also incredible. Give that a watch as well. But there's just The Rock and The Undertaker start getting really intense. And there's just a bit of Kurt Angle standing on the side. He starts jumping up and down, waving his arms like, pay attention to me. I'm Kurt Angle. You will look at me. And they both look at him, just kick the shit out of him for a couple of minutes so they can clear him out the ring and go at each other. It's just great. The chemistry in it is phenomenal. Cannot recommend it highly enough. It's one of my kind of, it's almost like a guilty pleasure in a lot of ways. It's just a match that I'll always go back to if I just want a damn good, just sit and mark out for 20 minutes. That's a match that I can go back to. It's not all about the intensity and stuff of, you know, maybe the WrestleMania 17 main event. It's a very different feel to it. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just different. And it is just outstanding. So my match of the week, the main event of Vengeance 2002 for the WWE Undisputed title, Champion The Undertaker versus Kurt Angle versus The Rock in a triple threat match.
A fabulous addition to a historic career that The Undertaker had. It's one of his most forgotten matches, actually, in a weird way. When you think of Undertaker's great classics, nobody ever thinks back to the American Badass era where he really started to kick in and actually create some of his finest wrestling performances, like the ladder match with Jeff Hardy as well, the matches with Kurt Angle that he had one-on-one. You know, even street fights with people like Ric Flair, he brought a new level of skill to his wrestling ability, which he carried forward as he, you know, went back to the dead man in future years. And that American Badass era is like one of the most underrated eras, full stop, for a wrestler I've ever known. It's incredible, the body of work that he created. And I think that, for me, is probably the pinnacle of that, is that match with The Rock and Kurt Angle. Arguably, at that you know, I don't think I've ever seen a triple threat with three stronger and more iconic wrestlers.
No.
There's been one-on-ones, but there's never been a triple threat where the three men are, and not only that, they're all world-class athletes in their own right and world-class characters too. The pinnacle, and it also shows a level of trust in someone like a Kurt Angle that he's able to step in there with a rock in the Undertaker, and he doesn't look out of place at all. Doesn't drown. It's an incredible match.
He's only been there 2 years as well. Kurt Angle only been there 2 years at that point. And, oh, yeah, you can main event for the title with The Undertaker and The Rock. It's fine. No one's going to bat an eyelid at that. That shows the incredible rise of Kurt Angle in a very short space of time in professional wrestling. That's incredible.
Yeah, I sort of echoed your sentiment of when we're something a bit more serious this week after the carny bollocks and all the nonsense we've been coming out with lately. Mine's on a different kind of feel, though. The 12th of June 2005, we saw the return of something quite special for one night only. It was ECW's One Night Stand from the Hammerstein Ballroom. This match is far more of a violent, hardcore affair, but it's also testament to how sometimes... I love the fact you mentioned guilty pleasure at the end. This, for me, is a ridiculously guilty pleasure. This match is a car crash, but it's so intense and so aggressive and so violent, and summed up a rivalry that had come 8 years before that in Japan. And it's the match between Mike Awesome and Masato Tanaka. It is quite possibly one of the most vicious affairs I have ever seen in wrestling history. This is a death match without being ridiculously over the top. The chair shots alone are frankly mind-altering. I cannot understand how Masato Tanaka to this day still is alive after this match. Like, these chair shots. Mike Awesome is a huge man, 6'8", 6'9", a leviathan of a man, a man who took $3 million to piss all over ECW and walk to WCW and become that 70s guy. Yes, Mike Awesome is taking a steel chair and launching himself from the top rope and drilling it into an unprotected head of Masato Tanaka, who actually, out of sheer stubbornness, refuses to even remotely attempt to block a steel chair shot. He would literally offer his head and allow Mike Awesome to swing at him like he is a baseball. It is terrifying. The match itself is unbelievably wonderful to watch while being tinged with a certain level of guilt. Some of the things, the power bomb over the Mike Awesome bomb over the top rope for a table, you know, he folds him up in half and Masato Tanaka takes the bump on his neck on the outside. You got Joey Styles in full flight on this match as well, with Mick Foley as the color commentator.
Yes.
Holy shit. Styles commentary alone is 5-star for the grotesque. It's utterly incredible. And Mike Awesome, rather tragically, took his own life a few years back. And what makes it even more haunting is that during this match, Mike Awesome does a suicide dive. And Joey Styles, who has obviously got an axe to grind and thought, this is my one opportunity on live WWE television to basically be a shoot bastard, and shouts at the top of his voice, suicide dive by Mike Awesome, and it's a shame he didn't succeed in taking his own life. It's one of the most horrifying lines I've ever heard. And to know all these years later that he actually did take his own life is just eerie and terrifying. But it also summed up what this was about. These were two men who weren't interested in playing up to any kind of level of professionalism. These were two men who were going to fucking hurt each other. They'd had matches before in Wrestle and Romance War in Japan. But Masato Tanaka and Mike Awesome, the reason for this One Night Stand was basically, let's get a nostalgic trip out of ECW. Let's remind people just once what these guys could do. So this is one of the most historic moments of the original ECW. And they'd wrestled each other at ECW Heatwave 1998 in this utter fucking war. But this match was basically a copy of that with an added level of intensity. You know, let's leave it all out there. Chances are neither of us are coming back. And Mike Awesome has had some historic moments. He was the very first man to fire a shot You know, when it came to the Alliance angle, he was the man who powerbombed Rhino and won the hardcore title wearing a WCW t-shirt. He was involved in the only time ever when Taz took on Mike Awesome for the ECW title. Mike Awesome was a WCW wrestler, and he defended the ECW title in an ECW arena against a WWF contracted Taz. You just think about that for a moment.
That's mind-boggling.
That's just it. You're not getting that now. That is a once-in-a-lifetime moment. Mike Awesome, actually one of the more underrated wrestlers for his size, an incredible athlete, an incredible testament and will to his ferocity in the ring. He'd take a lot of damage. Credit to Mike Awesome. He would take it as well as he would dish it out with Masato Tanaka. This match is a car crash. It is actually terrifying. And from the get-go, it will punch you in the fucking face and it will be relentless until it stops. It is that kind of match. But if you want something different and you want an epitome of how to do a wrestling match with hardcore elements instead of having a match where it is just hardcore elements, this is a better example of that. These two men were loved by the ECW faithful and with good reason. It's obviously ECW won this down 2005. It's only about 12 or 13 minutes long. You can't explain it. You can't explain what you have seen. It is legitimately a stiff steel chair shot to your own spine. The senses, it livens you up. And you feel terrible for it. But you can't stop watching it. And I've watched this match 30, 40 times. And I still am mind blown by it. It's a spectacle. It really is. In the same way people stop in the motorway to see a car crash, the morbidity of it, you can't help but watch these two men try and murder each other. It's truly unique. What's also good is the fact that it doesn't have the bloodshed of an ECWS. There's no cheese grater. There's no blading. It is just men striking each other. It's two legendary blunt hammers of the ECW faithful just colliding. It's very, very strange. In some ways, it's like watching a very carny kind of war between two gods. In the way you would watch Thor and Loki smash each other around in a Marvel epic, this is like almost like a homeless version of that. But nonetheless, you still can't take your eyes off it. It's weird. Bone wars. It's like watching, basically, it's like watching two homeless men war over a chicken leg. But it is utterly spellbinding in a way. So my match of the week, excuse me, is Mike Awesome versus Masato Tanaka from ECW One Night Stand 2005. So Steve, give us some plugs, mate, and let's take it home.
Well, obviously thank you to everyone for listening to this. Follow us on the Twitter at the Smark Plug on Twitter. That's where we'll have our poll, so you can decide what we talk about each week. We both put up a poll of subjects for you to talk about. You pick, you choose, you vote, whatever has the most votes, we talk about that week on Manic Mondays. You can also find us on Facebook, just search The Smark Plug on Facebook. You can find us and follow us there. We'll be uploading plenty of videos, including videos of our matches of the week, and putting posts up there about various competitions and other shenanigans that are going on in the Smark Plug universe. You can also look for the Global Canvas Club website, globalcanvasclub.com. There you can look at a bunch of wrestling articles, which Amir in particular contributes to, along with some of our most loyal listeners. If you want to get in touch with us, feel free on the DM or on the Twitter, or of course on the Facebook as well. You can get hold of me at my personal Twitter, which is at SteveTheDuke87, at SteveTheDuke87, if you want to talk to me about any form of wrestling, and keep your ears out for other podcasts in the Smart Plug Galaxy. We have up a SummerSlam review from last week's SummerSlam. We also have the Week in the Universe Part 1, where we look through the latest goings-on SmackDown and Raw. And Week in the Universe Part 2, where we look at the goings-on 205 Live and NXT. And especially with the recent NXT TakeOver 3 in Brooklyn, that's something to listen out for as well. And of course, keep your ears out for the Indie 50 podcasts, which pop their head up every time there is some very top quality independent wrestling to update you on. So, I think with that, I think I've remembered the majority of them. If not, I'm sure Amir will clean up my shit after me. But thank you very much for listening, as always. Been a quality podcast this week. And look forward to seeing you guys down the road.
No question, mate. Succinctly done. Very professionally done. It's getting to the point where I don't really have much to add. Obviously, I have a personal Twitter account at Dunham Devil. If you need to get hold of me or want to speak to me on a plethora of different interests, including football, mental health awareness, and other such things, at Dunham Devil. Dunham is spelled D-U-N-H-O-L-M-E. At Dunham Devil for me. And of course, Steve has plugged everything else. So it gives me great pleasure to say thank you very much for listening to Manic Mondays. We love doing it. And of course, it is always hashtag for the fans. Ladies and gentlemen, look after yourselves, be safe out there, and we will catch you very soon for another podcast from the Smart Plug universe. From myself, Miraz Nadi, and from Steve Neal, thank you very much for listening, and take care of yourselves.
Well, folks, we're all out of time. This is Johnny Gomez saying good fight, good night.